Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
Seventy-five years ago, the United States dropped the first ever atomic bomb on Hiroshima. It turned out to be an era-defining attack. Not only did hundreds of thousands of civilians die, but it instilled a fear of nuclear weapons and a sense of awe at their destructive power that pervaded and changed the world, leading, in part, to a wave of arms control agreements between the United States and the Soviet Union that helped us keep the threat of nuclear war down. But now, in the past 10 to 20 years, arms control agreements have come under attack, and especially in the Trump administration, the arms control regime that has allegedly kept the world safe from nuclear weapons has started to really fall apart in earnest. Today on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network, we're going to examine what has happened to the world's arms control agreements and what can be done to salvage them. I'm Zach Beauchamp, here as always with Jen Williams and Alex Ward. I don't know why I said as always, because I was off last week, and I'll be off again next week. Hello, team. I hope you're happy that I'm back.
So happy.
Zach, happy to be here with you somewhat always.
Somewhat always, part of the time. Hey, before we get too much into this episode, I know some listeners are probably wondering why we're not talking about the explosion in Lebanon and the fallout from that. The reason is that our sister podcast Today Explained did an excellent episode on it that included an interview with a Lebanese journalist and does a lot of really thoughtful work on the topic. So I'd encourage you, if you're looking for more details on what happened in Lebanon, to go listen to that. But we thought it was really important to talk about the nature of the arms control regime right now, because while the risk of nuclear war is low, like really low, at all times that risk is still with us so long as these weapons exist. And now the risk of a nuclear miscalculation actually is going up. People who watch these things and are obsessed with them, they're really concerned about what is happening to our arms control regime and how that could make a world-ending catastrophe more likely. Again, it's still really low, but the risk is slowly increasing thanks to these agreements that most Americans don't really know about, or most people in the world don't really know about, and it affects all of us, literally every person on the planet. So this is a really important topic. Alex has just written a very, very long piece. Really, it's quite long, but you should read all of it. But yeah, look, I guess we should start by talking about the history of arms control, because it's difficult to understand why people are so concerned about what's happening right now if you don't understand how we got here. So let's roll all the way back to the aftermath of World War II and the U.S. nuclear use at Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
So a quick definition, when we talk about arms control, what we're actually talking about is agreements between countries to limit the size of their weapons. In this particular conversation, we're talking about nuclear weapons. There are arms control agreements for missiles and things, and those do feature in what we'll discuss. But generally speaking, we're talking about countries, especially the U.S. and Russia, or then the Soviet Union, limiting the size of their massive nuclear arsenals, seeing as they are the two with the largest amounts. Okay, so World War II. August 6, 1945, the U.S. drops an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, kills about 70,000 people initially, heads up to about 200,000 over time. 3 days later, August 9th, another one on Nagasaki kills, if I recall, around 40,000, and then ends up with around 140,000 more dead over time. So massive loss of life. Let's not forget, of course, tons of radiation issues, tons of health concerns after this drops, economic devastation. But World War II ends, in part, because these bombs were dropped. So what happened? Jen is giving me the wishy-washy hand. I mean, there's literature saying that the nuclear weapons were part of it, but there is more complication. But for the simplicity of the story, let's just say that it played a pretty big part.
I'm not going to concede to that either. It's much more complicated than that. And the more recent scholarship suggests it's not. But we're not going to get sidetracked by this. Go on, Alex.
Right. All right. Let me just say, so we can all be happy, after the weapons are dropped, it played some role in some way with World War II ending. Okay. So what comes out of this? Well, there's a bunch of people going, wait a minute, that seemed like a bad idea. It was pretty horrifying, not only because of the scenes that came out of it, but because of the devastation that these certain bombs could produce. So what you had was the rise of an anti-nuclear movement that sprang up in the U.S. and in Europe and elsewhere, basically saying like, hey, this is a pretty devastating weapon, a pretty dangerous one, and we should probably not see this happen again. But of course, the U.S. has it. Soviet Union also gets the bomb. And so despite this, you know, anti-nuclear movement, you still see the U.S. and the Soviet Union have the bombs, and it actually causes a lot of tensions down the line.
Yeah. So, you know, Alex, in your piece, you lay out this like really, I think, fascinating kind of five big key important moments on the path to arms control. And like you said, the first one was, you know, the rise of the anti-nuclear movement, you know, in part directly in response to the use of nuclear weapons on Japan. The next one is a really critical one that I think a lot of people probably don't know or remember. I don't remember it particularly being taught in high school history class, but the U.S.-Soviet standoff over Berlin. So this happened in 1958. Nikita Khrushchev, who's was the head of the Soviet Union, the Soviet premier at the time, basically had a showdown with Dwight Eisenhower and then later on with President Kennedy. It was basically this fight between the Soviet Union and the West over, you know, over Berlin, over Germany. At the time, remember, it's divided, right? So the Soviet Union kind of has control over East Berlin. U.S., French, and British troops are in West Berlin. The Soviets want to get all of the Western troops out of West Berlin so that they can take control of the entire city of Berlin. The standoff kind of escalates when Kennedy comes into office. He gives this kind of dramatic 1961 speech where he kind of says, we must be ready to resist with force. And it gets really scary. And a lot of people worry that like this could be the first like nuclear kind of conflagration between these two nuclear powers. In the end, Alex, as you explained really well, there was a kind of back channel between Kennedy and Khrushchev that de-escalate. But it really scared a lot of people that like, oh my God, these two powers are literally like right up against each other and they could very easily go nuclear. And then, you know, that again happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Which is something I assume a lot of you are pretty familiar with, the standoff between the United States and the Soviet Union over Soviet placement of nuclear missiles and weapons in Cuba, which was arguably precipitated by the U.S. placement of nuclear weapons in Turkey. This is one of those things that historians like to debate, that whether the U.S. or the Soviet Union is actually responsible for the Cuban Missile Crisis. But the point is, the U.S. was so angry about this, about the Soviet missiles being placed in Cuba, that the two countries very nearly went to war over the issue of whether or not the U.S. would launch some kind of attack on the Cuban emplacements there. And the U.S. came very, very close to doing so. It was probably the closest the world has ever been to a nuclear exchange. There were a few other options, which were sort of accidents. And I will talk about those later because I'm kind of obsessed with them. But they're not relevant for present purposes. The reason that the Cuban Missile Crisis is so important is because it was one that was not just somebody saw something on radar and got freaked out. It was that the leaders of the two countries were like this close to launching nuclear weapons at each other. And that realization that the situation between the two superpowers at the time was so tense that something like moving missiles around could potentially trigger a preemptive nuclear strike, or at least a preemptive strike that could escalate to nuclear war, created incentives on both sides to try to negotiate and tamp down on the nuclear arms race and keep nuclear weapons under control and create agreements that, crucially, and this is something people don't fully understand about arms control agreements, aren't just designed to prevent people from getting more weapons. They are designed to place limitations on the kinds of weapons that they have in order to prevent weapons that might make it harder for the other side to detect a launch, or might make it easier for one side to believe that they could survive a nuclear attack from coming into existence. The idea is to preserve the framework of mutually assured destruction such that everybody knows that if nuclear weapons are launched, it would be catastrophic for their side. Therefore, no one will ever dare launch a nuclear weapon in the first place. That's the idea behind the subsequent architecture of arms control agreements. And the US and the Soviet Union developed a number of them over the course of the 20th century. In order for these agreements to come into existence, there needed to be a few other things needed to happen.
Yeah, and very briefly, you had China test its first nuclear device in 1964. The Soviet Union, of course, had bombs, but Britain and France were the others. And so this was the US going like, wait a minute, it's proliferating, it's going everywhere, we can't control it. And then relatedly, you had the Soviet Union and Chinese break off relations, or at least start to drift apart, not only because of the nuclear weapons. The main issue was a split in really ideological differences over the role of communism in the world, but also in their own countries. And so because of this, you started to have the US and Soviet Union come together and be like, all right, maybe we need to solve this nuclear thing. Maybe we need to start making some agreements so we don't blow each other up and start to pull back from the brink here.
So the US and the Soviet Union come together. They make this kind of historic accord, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 1972. And, you know, without going into the gritty details of all of this, basically what happens is over the course of the next many decades, the US and the Soviet Union come together and make a series of pacts, a series of agreements that, you know, basically form the framework of arms control, of nuclear arms control. They do things like, you know, limiting, like Zach was saying, the number of weapons, limiting the types of weapons. They also do really important things that are not specifically just about numbers and types of weapons, but that are about verification that actually really kind of underscores the entire arms control regime, which is essentially sets up these different agreements, set up mechanisms whereby the U.S. and the Soviet Union and then later Russia can essentially inspect each other's facilities, make sure that they are, you know, each other is playing by the rules. They can also set up mechanisms whereby they can like talk to each other. So if they're moving a missile around, say they're moving a missile from one facility to another, they can, you know, send a notice or actually have to send a notification to the other side and say, look, we're moving this over here because we need to work on it or whatever, so that you don't have, you know, a repeat of something like the Cuban Missile Crisis, where moving missiles around almost started a nuclear war. So it kind of, all of these agreements really set that in place. And, you know, over the past several decades, it has led to this kind of period of nuclear, you know, I don't know, stability, but of arms control stability.
At the very least, we haven't been super worried about the two sides intentionally going to nuclear war with each other. That is to say, right, the United States and the Soviet Union, which have like 93% of the world's nuclear weapons.
Right. And that's all starting to unravel.
Right. So the process here starts with the George W. Bush administration after 9/11. Their orientation towards treaties and arms control started to change because the concern was less about war between nuclear-armed superpowers or large powers and more about a terrorist group or a rogue nation affiliated with terrorists, as the way the Bush administration thought about particularly Iran and North Korea and Iraq at the time, getting some kind of nuclear weapon and launching one at the United States in a kind of terroristic strike rather than a full-on nuclear exchange. So they started reorienting policy towards preventing that kind of threat, which also meant that arms control agreements that limited the U.S. ability to, for example, develop anti-ballistic missiles that could shoot down a missile when it was incoming didn't make very much sense to the administration under this particular framework at that time. I'm not defending the move. I'm merely explaining the logic that led to it. There was a revival of arms control in the Obama administration, which had, you know, the President Obama was famously very concerned with nuclear weapons on a personal matter and had at one point discussed getting rid of nuclear weapons entirely. His administration ends up signing a deal with then Russian President Dmitry Medvedev that's a sort of major new nuclear arms control agreement called New START, referencing an old START, which is one of the arms control agreements signed during the Cold War. And that was a real landmark. And it seemed like that between that and the Iran nuclear deal, the Obama administration was making progress towards a world of enhanced arms control agreements. But then the Trump administration comes in. And I mean, you can kind of guess what happens given the Trump administration's broad antipathy towards international agreements, not just the Iran nuclear agreement, but like the idea of international agreements in general. They're not fans.
So before going on to Trump, don't want to give the Obama administration a pass. They did, in order to get New START, okay, a nuclear modernization program that many people are still very upset with because it will cost billions to do and to move forward, and people think it's unnecessary. But that was the trade they made to get New START. So we talked about, there are only three you really need to know when it comes to the Trump administration. One is called the INF, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which is about medium-range missiles. Another one called Open Skies, which is basically allowing overflights of countries that are in the deal to make sure that they could see how other, if other countries were developing armies or nuclear facilities or whatever. It basically was a confidence-building measure. And then New START, as Zach just outlined, which limited the ways that the U.S. and Russia could use certain nuclear weapons and missiles and, like, the size of those arsenals. Okay. So Trump comes in. He's already pretty concerned about nuclear weapons and nuclear war. In fact, he'd said in even Playboy magazines in interviews about how concerned he was about, just a nuclear hellfire, about a mushroom cloud, about going to that kind of conflict. And so it's something that he has thought about, at least, even if it's not deeply, he has thought about and seems scared of, and I've always thought he seems genuinely scared of, nuclear war. So, all right. Yet, when he is in office, he starts to tear down nuclear agreements. We're going to skip over like North Korea and Iran here, although we should note Trump has tried to make some sort of nuclear deal with North Korea, and of course he is withdrawn the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, although he says it's in order to get a stronger deal down the line with Iran on a whole range of issues which we've talked about on the show. But we'll start with INF. And the reason the Trump administration wanted out of INF is simply because they claimed, as the Obama administration did, that Russia cheated on the deal. In effect, that they developed the kind of missile that the deal prohibited. And not only that, but deployed it forward. And so for a lot of people in the Trump administration and those outside of it, including some that formerly served in the Obama administration, they said, look, this is a bilateral deal. If one side is cheating, it makes no sense for the United States to stay in it. And in fact, what it will do is limit America's ability to defend itself while Russia's developing, and so we would be stupid to do it. Plus, does the U.S. really believe in arms control? Would not arms control be strengthened if we held Russia accountable for cheating on deals like this? So the U.S. withdrew from it. We are no longer an INF. Russia is no longer an INF. And that is one arms control deal that took some time to make. It was made in the Reagan administration. That is off the books.
Yeah. The second one is Open Skies, as Alex described earlier. This kind of allows, you know, overflights from by countries that are involved in the agreements, not just the U.S. and Russia in this case, but basically for the same exact reason as what Alex just laid out with the INF. The Trump administration decided that the U.S. would withdraw from Open Skies. They did this just recently in May. The U.S. isn't officially out. It kicked off, basically his announcement kicked off this like 6-month clock before the U.S. can officially leave the deal. Again, the Trump administration is saying that Russia cheated, that they've been, you know, violating Open Skies, that it's kind of undermined the entire point of the agreement. Therefore, the U.S. shouldn't participate anymore, and we're going to leave. But again, you know, when they do that, Trump at the same time says there's a good chance we'll make a new agreement or do something to put it back together. So again, the kind of Trump MO, I'm going to leave this international agreement, whether it's on nuclear weapons or trade or whatever, but I'm going to try to get a better deal. The problem is, you know, and we'll get into that, whether he can actually get a better deal.
There's almost never a better deal.
Yeah, on any of these things.
Two quick things on Open Skies just to clarify as well, Trump administration thinking, or at least Trump ally thinking. One is they were saying, look, when the deal was signed, we didn't really have these great satellites that can look in on other countries. Again, this overflight deal of Open Skies is just like rickety planes going over areas and like looking down with cameras and being like, okay, that they're not building nuclear silos.
Some of the planes are pretty nice.
Not really. but anyway.
On this podcast, we stand the SR-71.
Wow.
So much.
I didn't realize this is an SR-71 fan podcast.
Blackbird for life. That is my favorite plane ever. Anyway.
The Blackbird's a pretty great plane.
It's really cool.
It is. But anyway. These look like 747s. They're not that exciting. But anyway, all this to say is that there are some who claim that, like, look, because we have more advanced satellites, we can basically do this kind of they would say overflights or spying without the need for these planes.
And we can just use Google Earth instead of open Google skies.
Right. And Planet Labs or whatever, and et cetera. So we don't need this and we can spend our money elsewhere. And then, as Jen alluded to, the cheating was along the lines of like where the U.S. would always allow Russia to overfly American territory. The Russians would sometimes say, I don't remember. Niet, there it is. I was going to say nine. Niet. And then I was like, that's nine, right? Niet. And so there we are. So they want to pull out of open skies. But the thing that has me worried and why I wrote this behemoth that Jen said she would cut and then made it longer, so I'm not going to let that go by, is New START, which is we are months away from that expiring. That expires in February. And it is the last remaining nuclear deal between the U.S. and Russia. So again, it's basically just an agreement along the lines of what kinds of missiles and how many can you have and when can you shoot them, et cetera. And the reason the Trump administration doesn't want to be in this one is, there's an extension. There's an extension that literally Putin and Trump themselves can just decide up to 5 years, we're going to extend this agreement, which expires in February. Putin has said he would do it without preconditions. Trump has said, no, we're going to hold here for the main reason that he wants China involved. That's at least what he says. And there's good reason for that. People say it's not the craziest idea simply because China's arsenal is growing. It does have nuclear weapons, around 300. It's developing cyber abilities, hypersonic missiles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so bringing it into New START, or at least start having some sort of trilateral deal, would better reflect the current environment that we're in, as opposed to just a U.S.-Russia bilateral deal. The critics of that play would say, and then I know Jen has something to say, but the critics of this would say that China doesn't want to be part of any arms control deal. In fact, it wasn't part of this originally, so why hold up the extension just to get China in? But if there is no deal, even though the U.S. and Russia are talking about it and inviting China, which is not showing up, we may not have this deal anymore in February, in which case, adios, arms control that took decades and decades to make.
Yeah, I just want to kind of add to what you said. It's not just that we would like China to be in here, and so we're not going to extend it until we get China in. It's that the deal itself, if China is not going to play by these rules, then the deal itself is hamstringing the U.S. and Russia. But in the U.S. side, U.S. argument is like, look, if China is going to develop all these weapons that we can't develop, because we're in this agreement with Russia, why are we going to be in this agreement? Because China is doing all this stuff and it's really dangerous. We're not going to be able to counter China if we stay in this agreement. So either we pull out of the agreement so that we can effectively match China, or we get China into the agreement. So it's not just like, we'd love to have China as part of this. It's very much a sense of, we would like to be able to compete with China and make sure that we're not at a strategic disadvantage with our nuclear weapons and our nuclear arsenals, et cetera. So just want to kind of clarify that.
The problem, though, is that while there may be individually defensible rationales for pulling out of each of these treaties that could make sense on its own, in aggregate, the decline of the arms control regime pioneered by the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the Cold War and then extended sort of afterwards in various ways ends up overall raising the, again, still minuscule, but appreciable and scary given the stakes, risks of an actual nuclear war. And that's the kind of thing we're going to talk about after the break in a classic worldly cheery outro.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Welcome back, worldly listeners. We have been talking about the recent hits to the International Arms Control Agreement regime, the way that we've prevented nuclear weapons from spiraling out of control, specifically focusing on agreements between the United States and Russia, which have made up the backbone a lot of the international arms control architecture. Well, one thing we've been alluding to, but haven't really spelled out, are the ways in which this is particularly dangerous, right? And, we've been emphasizing that the risks of nuclear war are low, and they are. But the problem with nuclear weapons is that they really create incentives for one side to go first in an attempt to crush the other side's nuclear arsenal. And because if you don't go first, then you might get crushed in advance. And you might not be able to retaliate particularly effectively. So that's why there are nuclear weapons on submarines called second strike capabilities to ensure that even if your ground-based nuclear weapons get destroyed, that you still have a chance to retaliate, therefore deterring anyone from trying to launch a first strike. Again, the question is whether or not that's sufficient to deter some kind of first strike, and under what circumstances you can imagine an incident between, let's say, the United States and Russia escalating into a nuclear conflict, even though nobody directly wants one. And that's why you need things like, if not overflights, then certainly some means of verifying and understanding what the other side is doing. That's why you want to have agreements that limit the types of weapons that can be developed in order to prevent weapons that might make one side feel like they could be more advantaged in the case of some kind of nuclear exchange between the two sides. And so all of these different agreements work on pieces of that. And as they unravel, the risks of some kind of exchange between the two countries, let's say Putin decides he wants to try to test NATO's resolve by sending little green men, that is to say unmarked soldiers, into a NATO country like Estonia, well, there's that. That's a functionally, given the way that NATO works, an attack on the United States. And so the question is then, in that sort of scenario, what are the steps, the mistrust and the lack of communication and the lack of transparency surrounding nuclear weapons that could lead the two sides to escalate? And that's why I'm so worried about all of these cumulative developments. Again, there may be an individually defensible rationale for scrapping, let's say, the Open Skies Treaty, but in a world where we're eroding trust between the two sides and eroding mechanisms of verification, the worst-case scenario starts to become more plausible. And again, still really unlikely, but given how significant the risks that we're talking about are, that really scares me. I don't know about you guys, but I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think it's really worth noting, when you're talking about like the importance of these mechanisms and how these arms agreements work. So New START went into effect in 2011. And as of mid-July 2020, so as of the middle of last month, the U.S. and Russia had exchanged more than 20,000 notifications with each other about the state of their nuclear arsenals. That is so many. And it just kind of goes to really illustrate, like, this isn't just like once a year we send each other a memo on where our nukes are. Like, this is very serious. Anytime we do kind of, you know, any sort of, you know, movement or, you know, adjustment to our nuclear arsenals, we notify Russia so that there isn't any sort of, you know, confusion or miscommunication or miscalculation. And so, like, these are very real, tangible things that are involved in these agreements. They're not just like theoretical, like we pinky promise to not do nuclear things. Like, they're very, which is like the, by the way, worst pinky promise ever. But, but in all seriousness, these are real mechanisms. And if these go away, right, like we already have, you know, so much tension with the U.S. and Russia right now, you know, and just imagining the kind of miscommunication that could happen is really scary. And that's why these sorts of mechanisms are so absolutely critical.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most immediate consequence, and we're seeing it now, is that there could be an arms race after all this, right? So if you remove the limits on the kinds of missiles and weapons that you can develop, well, then countries are probably going to start building or revamping those kinds of missiles and arsenals. So you see Russia right now working on a hypersonic missile. Whether or not it works or is even close to working is a separate issue. It also claims it's nuclear powered, which is like scientifically really hard to produce, if not impossible. The U.S. military has recently shown off a hypersonic missile.
And those are troubling because a hypersonic missile is very hard to intercept or detect quickly.
Yeah, no, exactly. They go so fast and their cruise missile flies so low to the ground that like you can't stop them. Again, missile defense that we've talked about on the show is effectively shooting a bullet with a bullet. Well, if one bullet moves too fast and is undetectable, that bullet's probably going to hit its target. So there's that. You have Trump wanting to invest more in nuclear modernization following the Obama administration's lead on that. You have China building up its military and its nuclear arsenal and its other conventional missile capabilities and nuclear missile capabilities in order to fend off the United States and deter aggression. And then there's a deal that exists. It's called the NPT, which
the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
That. And there's a deal at the heart of it, which is that the countries that have, it's the 50th anniversary of it, like now. And there's a deal at the heart of it, which is the countries that have nuclear weapons, like, start to decline their numbers. And those that don't seek one. Well, if you remove the limits from countries that have nuclear weapons and they start developing more, then you may have other countries go, well, I want it too. And so a lot of this is not just like the politics of the US and Russia or you know, US, Russia, China. A lot of this is the signals that nuclear having states send to non-nuclear having states and other countries in the world going like, hey, this is a norm here in the world that we have nuclear weapons. We know it's bad. We're doing our best to, you know, limit them and sort of dismantle them slowly because you can't just sort of do it all at once for myriad reasons. But if that signal is gone, then you kind of have a free-for-all.
Yeah, you know, and that's, I think that's a really important point because it helps move us away from just the U.S. and Russia and to this kind of broader global, you know, conception of how we think of nuclear weapons and how countries see them as important or not important to their international security. And it's really scary. Just this week, the Wall Street Journal had an exclusive that China is apparently helping Saudi Arabia develop these uranium or kind of mines that can be used to mine yellowcake, which can then be eventually processed and potentially used in a nuclear weapon. Now, it's not news that China and Saudi Arabia have agreed to work together on nuclear issues, but you know, this is kind of another development in that kind of space. And you know, Saudi Arabia says, "Look, we're trying to diversify our energy portfolio, right? Like because you know." Nuclear energy is a thing. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to make nuclear weapons. And Saudi Arabia has for a long time said that it's going to diversify its country to be not so reliant completely on oil. The problem is that when that may sound reasonable, right, on its face, like, oh, it's just for nuclear energy. That's fine. But when you look at it in the context of the U.S. pulling out of the Iran nuclear agreement, right, and the possibility of Iran going after a nuclear weapon, you kind of then see it in the context of a broader regional arms race where, well, Iran gets the bomb, so Saudi needs to get the bomb. And you also have, you know, kind of this broader kind of issue of proliferation. And so having the breakdown of this kind of these global norms around, you know, the commitment to getting rid of nuclear weapons rather than getting more of them is really, really important in like a very tangible way immediately right now.
It's also worth noting that a lot of what we take for granted about the way that we think and talk about nuclear weapons is actually pretty contingent and could change pretty rapidly. One of my favorite books on the topic is Nina Tannenwald's work on the nuclear taboo. She's a political scientist at Brown, and her book argues that the reason that we haven't seen any nuclear use in terms of an actual deployment of nuclear weapons during an armed conflict since World War II, is that political leaders have constructed, and political leaders and NGOs and various different people who are involved in the deliberations here have constructed an idea that nuclear use is not acceptable as part of regular combat and as part of military operations. And this is something that people have come to believe as a matter of ideas and ideology and moral thinking, but it's not necessarily obviously the case at the level of strategic doctrine, right? Early after World War II, in the various different conflicts the U.S. saw itself in, like, for example, the Korean War, leading American generals advocated for the use of nuclear weapons, of limited use of nuclear weapons against non-nuclear foes with the attempt of winning a conventional war. The idea and the thinking was that nuclear weapons are a weapon like any other kind of weapon and can be deployed as part of any kind of regular military exercise. President Truman shot that thinking down, despite being the only president to have been in office while nuclear weapons were deployed in combat of any country, only head of state. But, you know, that was not obviously the case. It wasn't clearly that things were going to go that way. And the more that we evolve towards a permissive international structure where nuclear weapons are normalized and become something that can be developed again without fear or sanction or general threat, or at least, you know, proliferation and the idea of more deploying them more normally becomes routinized, the higher the risks will be that we'll see nuclear weapons use in our lifetime. And the U.S. has taken concrete steps in this direction, namely by putting low-yield nuclear weapons on a submarine. The whole point of these weapons, they're much smaller than what you'd ordinarily associate with a nuclear bomb. But the purpose of them is to be able to use them in combat, to use them as was envisioned by generals during the Korean War. As part of a thing that should, according to its proponents, prevent escalation. To my mind, it just makes it more likely that they get used during combat.
Yeah, and I mean, those days are back, as you rightly note. It should be said that the Trump administration did like a nuclear strategy review, missile defense review, and what was in it was this notion that low-yield nuclear weapons, tactical weapons, are like a good idea because it gives the commander on the ground more flexibility to use them. But the thinking in terms of deterrence that we've talked about on the show, and I know we've hit this point before, but I think it's important to mention, is the Trump administration's thinking here is that if there are more usable weapons, then deterrence goes up in the sense that, like, well, if it is more likely that the U.S. would use such a weapon, then it would deter another country from taking a provocative action.
Right.
What the document said, the Trump administration strategy said, was that the U.S. would consider using such a weapon in the case of like a non-nuclear attack or a non-conventional attack. In fact, it could even be like a cyber strike. Like, let's say China or Russia hacked a certain American city's electrical grid and shut it all down, or large parts of an American electrical grid. Well, that would at least consider, or at least trigger the thought that we could respond with a low-yield nuclear attack. That is what we're thinking about now. So this is where the Trump administration's head is at, collectively. It's this belief that the old arms control regime is no longer really applicable to today's environment. And as we've laid out, there are some at least logical reasons for why that could be. Although in this grander picture, what you're seeing is the Trump administration deciding that, in fact, sort of a more aggressive nuclear posture would lead to more nuclear peace. But there are tons of people saying that, in fact, that's making the risk of a nuclear catastrophe higher. Not high, but higher.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the idea of using these outside of even, like, a conflict with another nuclear power, I think, to me, you know, and thus, you know, kind of then lowering, you know, the threshold for use more broadly, you can see very real cases where you could consider the Trump administration considering doing that, right? So what I think about when I think about this is Afghanistan. You know, Trump already basically has allowed his generals to use really, really big conventional bombs. So the
mother of all bombs.
Yeah, so the Massive Ordnance Air Blast, the MOAB, also called the mother of all bombs. So in 2017, the U.S. dropped that bomb under the Trump administration on some ISIS caves, essentially. And, you know, again, not a nuclear weapon, just a really big bomb. But you could see if we had maybe tactical nukes in play, where Trump might consider doing something like that elsewhere. Or again, he has mused as recently as last year that he could wipe Afghanistan off the face of the earth if he wanted to, and defeat the Taliban, but also literally just destroy the entire country of Afghanistan. Now, you know, you may chalk that up to Trump just being Trump and saying that, but the fact that Trump is the president and, you know, could actually potentially cede more authority to his generals to use low-yield tactical nukes, you could see that being a possibility. And again, you know, yes, it's a low-yield nuke, it's still a nuclear weapon, and that goes to effectively destroying that nuclear taboo that Zach was talking about. And the more you have that normalized, the more it becomes likely that you'll see them in other conflicts. And then you just have this spiral out of control. And that's where, you know, people like the three of us get really, really scared when we see the ends of these kinds of agreements. Because, yes, it doesn't mean that, you know, as soon as this agreement, that, you know, New START lapses in February, the next day we're going to have a nuclear war. Like, that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is kind of a gradual series of chain, you know, chain reactions and events, not to
chain
use
reaction,
a
nice
nuclear pun on chain reaction, completely unintentional, but really glad I did that. But seriously, you know, kind of like a domino effect where, you know, gradually these things lead to other things and eventually we end up in a really scary nuclear situation. And so I think that's really what we're trying to impress upon you guys to understand. And we really want, you know, people to be thinking about, you know, nuclear arms control is not something that you think about on a daily basis, but it's serious and it really matters to the future of, you know, humanity.
And the last thing I want to say on this point, just related to what Jen was just saying, is that the nuclear weapons are not this thing. They seem hyper-rational and that everybody thinks about them carefully and develops these policies that are designed to make sure that they're only used under certain circumstances that are in a way that should minimize their use. But it's important to emphasize the role of chance in the fact that there hasn't been a nuclear exchange and individual judgment, because these things are a lot less certain than they may sound when you hear about high-level nuclear strategic doctrine. For example, in 1963, a Soviet lieutenant colonel saw his computer light up with a thing that said launch, that there was a U.S. launch coming at them. It turned out what was actually happening was the sun's reflection off of clouds, but his computer misinterpreted that as an American preemptive strike. And it was up to him to decide whether or not to launch a retaliatory strike, what he thought would be. He didn't. But it's this guy, Stanislav Petrov, who I think we now all rightly remember as a hero, that prevented us from getting into a nuclear exchange in 63. And there are more recent incidents. There are really scary ones in 1995. This is, again, after the Cold War, where a bunch of American-Norwegian scientists launched a science rocket, not anything like a nuclear weapon. But the Russian government didn't tell their radar technicians, and it looked to one of them like there was an American nuclear missile incoming. And so Russian President Boris Yeltsin at the time had a decision to make as to whether or not he thought the Americans were striking. Now, given the geopolitics of the time, that seemed very unlikely. And Yeltsin ended up not launching, obviously, and things were fine. But think about those two incidents and think about the way in which technical glitches or a lack of information being conveyed through the proper channels created the risk for an apocalyptic nuclear exchange. Now imagine something similar happens in countries that are in a more antagonistic relationship, perhaps maybe India and Pakistan, India and China, the United States and China, North Korea and the United States. And think about this sort of thing happening under conditions where the arms control framework internationally has been eroded, more advanced nuclear technologies that incentivize first strikes are deployed, and there's just generally not good communication and high levels of mistrust. Well, you can imagine things going the other way, right? And again, I'm not saying any of that is likely. None of us are saying that. What we are saying is that this is a risk that can't be ignored, and given the stakes, requires some kind of more assertive diplomatic effort to prevent these sort of things from spiraling out of control.
And just, you know, to add to Zach's list, there's always the chance of accident. You actually had a plane break up over Goldsboro, North Carolina, 1961, an American plane, and nuclear bombs dropped down. They didn't explode, but you could imagine what would have happened if they did. So that's the kind of risk we have just carrying these weapons. But let me offer some good news. One is that the Trump administration is in negotiations with Russia right now over extending New START and potentially other arms control issues. So despite all the tough talk, despite the general ideological orientation of this administration, it is possible that we actually have more arms control, not less, by the end of it. And let's say Biden were to come into office, if he wins in November, he is committed to more arms control, has committed to extending New START. And so I think it is possible. There are many, don't vote for whoever you want, but it does seem that the future of arms control, the future of nuclear issues, the nuclear risk is at stake in this election. That there are at least very diverging viewpoints on where the U.S. could go. So this isn't a fait accompli, right? It is possible that America's nuclear future and global nuclear risk goes down. So that's something to keep in mind when you're thinking about, like, after we've talked about everything being scary. Again, the risk is low. There are some movement towards more arms control. It's not all going away yet, but we're close.
So that's our show today, folks. I want to thank our producer, Jackson Bierfeldt, for all of his hard work on the episode. And I want to encourage all of you to rate and subscribe and review Worldly wherever you get your podcasts. Reminder, I'll be off again next week on what's probably my last vacation before paternity leave. So I'll be with you through the fall, at least after this. But
will be here. So please still tune into Worldly.
That's right. That's right. And remember, it's paternity leave. It's only temporary. And it's not happening yet. So anyway, you guys enjoy next week's show without me, and I will see you when I'm back.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smart Water Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure, it's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smart Water Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.